Well, like Anton, I was kind of vacillating a bit about the talk title, but anyway, this is what I settled on. And I do want to say that this conference is, as far as I can recollect, a first for me in my entire career, because there are actually two people speaking in this conference named Fiona, which has never happened to me before. All right. very good. Okay. So, you know, basically, this is a talk about the connections between the following themes. One theme is sort of, you know, symmetries and the way they act on anions in two dimensions. And the other theme is, you know, what people call generalized or non-invertible symmetries in one-dimensional systems. And I want to, you know, share some concrete thoughts of, you know, certain relationships between these two things, and what those relationships maybe allow us to say about, you know, kind of finding, for example, these examples of these non-invertible symmetries. And, you know, as many of you know, a lot of these questions are much more easily tackled in the context of discrete symmetries than continuous symmetries. And for the experts in the audience, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but this will be a talk that really focuses on discrete symmetries quite specifically. All right. So I was not entirely sure, you know, what the kind of common background of this audience is. So I'm going to start from the beginning, which is, you know, symmetries and anions. So first of all, what is an anion? You know, an anion, for the purposes of this talk, is a particle in 2+1 dimensions which has statistical interactions such that it is neither a fermion nor a boson. Okay, and this has a long history in condensed matter physics, dating back to, you know, even before people had experimentally discovered the fractional quantum Hall effect. Okay, so you know some kind of fractional self statistics, right? So what does this mean? Well, you know, here's a particle, here's another particle. This guy is going to go around the other guy. Topologically speaking, that's equivalent to exchanging them twice. And when you do this double exchange for either fermions or bosons, you get a phase factor of plus one. But, you know, that need not be the case. You could get some other phase, and you could even get some kind of, you know, essentially matrix if there's a multidimensional Hilbert space here. Okay. And so that's anions. And, you know, another thing that happens, so the real-life situation where we have very convincing empirical evidence for anions is the fractional quantum Hall effect. And what's fractional about the fractional quantum Hall effect is really the fractionalization of the electric charge. And what that means is that microscopically you have a system that is made up of electrons. But if you kind of look at the low energy, low temperature, long wavelength properties of this system, it can look as if these electrons, you know, aren't really kind of the fundamental charge carriers. And the fundamental charge carriers are something that carry a fraction of the electron's charge, such as E over 3. And it took people a very long, I actually should have put the reference here. It's taken people a very long time to really, you know, kind of measure this E over 3. But recently, I think there's relatively, you know, there are experiments that I think really suggest that that's what's going on. Okay. Good. And so, you know, we have this like kind of fractional statistics, fractional charge. Okay, they both have the word fractional, but there's a more sort of fundamental reason that you might expect these things to be related, as they are in nature when we look for systems, you know, where we might actually see this in the lab. Okay. And the reason is that both of these are necessarily emergent phenomena, okay? Because we don't have any, you know, material where, you know, we're putting in anything other than like electrons or, you know, spins of nuclei, okay? So in order to get, say, fractional electric charge, that has to be an emergent property of some low energy state. And obviously, you know, in nature, we don't have anything that's not a fermion or a boson. And so these fractional statistics are also necessarily emergent, okay? So this is kind of what we call symmetry fractionalization. And it's very natural for it to come hand in hand with this kind of emergence of anions. Okay, and the two kind of candidate material systems where people look for these things are, as I said, the fractional quantum Hall effect, and also what people call quantum spin liquids, where you can draw these lovely pictures. Good. All right. Now, about, you know, sort of, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, people started getting quite interested in thinking about symmetries of anion systems more generally than just kind of what we believe occurs in, say, the fractional quantum Hall effect. And one of the reasons that people wanted to do this is that they wanted to understand how to make, in some kind of synthetic way, in a real material, something that was going to behave like a specific kind of anion that we call a non-abelian anion. Why would you want to do that? Because non-abelian anions are potentially useful, for example, for building stable memories for quantum computers. Okay, and one of the observations that you can use to do this is that, you know, actually fractional charge is not the only kind of interesting and quite non-trivial way that symmetry can act in systems with anions. Okay, so certain kinds of and you know, if anyone, I should say that if I'm using words that any of you don't know, please stop me, because like I said, I didn't have a super concrete picture of what the common background of this audience is, okay? But basically, if we look at sort of topological orders, so model theories describing the mathematical structure of anions in two spatial dimensions, so 2 plus 1D, there's another kind of symmetry that can act actually by, for example, permuting the anion types, okay? And around this time, there were a series of works that essentially pointed out that if you think about these kinds of symmetries and you make some kind of symmetry defect, so here's a picture from a paper by Mason Barkeshley and Xiaoling Qi, where this is their picture of a symmetry defect, and at the endpoint of this symmetry defect lives one of these exotic sort of non-abelian anions that seem to be very difficult to get just by, you know, putting materials into extreme conditions. Okay. And so that led people to think about, you know, more generally the structure of these anion permuting symmetries. And I should say that if you want to read about this in great and gory detail, there are many examples as well as a very thorough discussion of the complete theory in this paper here, which, by the way, was posted on the archive in 2014. So there's a long delay there. but here are some examples of the kind of, you know, situations where this might arise. So, you know, one thing that you can do, you want to have a topological order that has some symmetry of the anions, is you can simply take two copies of that, and this, you know, which is depicted here as two layers of a system, and the symmetry can swap these two copies. Okay, and actually, in this paper, you know, one of the systems in which they pointed out that this is kind of a natural thing to think about is if you have a lattice model with a churn number 2, okay, that these kinds of defects are naturally realized as lattice translation symmetry defects. And we now have an exciting new class of materials known as moiré materials, where bands of churn number 2 or higher appear to arise rather naturally. So I think it's an exciting time to think about these kinds of proposals a little more carefully. But that's one example, okay? Another example is I might have, you know, what we call Zn topological order, okay, so abelian anions, where if you take n of them together, they are topologically trivial. And these kinds of things always have some kind of charge conjugation symmetry, where I interchange the charge 1 with the charge n minus 1 and do the same thing to the fluxes. And another example, which is the one that I'm going to focus on for some concreteness today, is in what we call the toric code. So this is a topological order that has two anions, which are usually referred to as E and M, okay? Sorry, well, and their product is a fermion, two bosons, E and M, and their product is a fermion, which I'll call epsilon. And here's a sort of depiction of the S matrix of this theory, which has, so, you know, this entry here is E around E, this entry here is I take an E around an M, and so on, okay? And you'll notice that this matrix just has a symmetry. If I permute these two columns and these two rows at the same time, you get back the same matrix, okay? And that's because this topological order has a sort of symmetry in which both of these, in which you can exchange these two bosons. Okay. And just to orient us, I actually want to say a little bit more in detail about this sort of symmetry. So this is a symmetry of the topological order. And if you kind of go back in the literature, so the toric code, you know, at some level is essentially no different from a Z2 lattice gauge theory, which goes back, you know, many, many decades. But kind of we call it the toric code because of a paper by Alexei Kataev, where he was thinking about it as a way to write down a sort of quantum code useful for quantum computing. And we can realize it on the lattice with the following Hamiltonian. So each edge of this lattice has a spin 1/2 degree of freedom, so a two-state system. Okay, and then you can write down a Hamiltonian, which basically has vertex terms that require that the product of these spins around each vertex be even. Okay, so if you take the spin down edges and color them in, then in this ground state I have to get closed loops only. And then around each plaquette, I'm going to take the product of sigma x. Okay, that just moves these closed loops around. It doesn't open them up. Okay, and then you can think of the Torah code by thinking of the ground state of this nice Hamiltonian. It's a very nice Hamiltonian to think about because it's a commuting projector model, and you can solve everything exactly. Okay, and so in this context, who are E and M? Well, E and M are excitations in the ground state of this Hamiltonian. So like I said, the ground state is kind of this, soup of loops associated with edges where the spins are down. And how do I make excitations? Well, there's two kinds of excitations, one of which lives at vertices, okay? And I make those by applying a sort of string of poly X operators, okay? And I make so this string everywhere along its line commutes with the Hamiltonian, and so the only places where this system is not in its ground state are the endpoints of the string. And similarly, I can make a string of sort of poly Z operators along the dual lattice, okay? And everywhere along the length of this string, the system is in its ground state, but at its endpoints, these plaquette terms are violated, okay? And so the excitations that we call E and M in this topological order are concretely realized on the lattice at the endpoints of these, sort of strings on the direct lattice and strings on the dual, which are what we call E, or the charges of this Z2 gauge theory, and the endpoints of strings on the dual lattice, which are what we call M.
Question?
Yes.
So this picture you showed before with two layers and a line, and you said that there is an interesting particle at the end of the line. Should this be thought as what you just described? Anions live at the ends of strings.
Yes, in a sense, but so let me say one thing about that picture. So, why realize, because, so maybe in a little while I will start talking about something like string net models, okay? Like, if I, as a theorist, you give me any Hilbert space I want and the capacity to make any interaction I want, I can make a whole bunch of these things. Non-abelian anions, no problem. But, the reason that people were interested in defects is that what nature gives us in the lab is basically, maybe if you work really hard, maybe like the 5/2 quantum Hall state does have non-abelian anions, but let's just say that that's been a very big challenge. And so the insight was, nature gives us abelian anions. Okay, that we're quite confident of. How can I take those abelian anions and achieve something that looks non-abelian, right? And so, like I said, one of these early proposals was go to a band of Chern number 2, and have some kind of, a fractional quantum Hall state there, and then look at these lattice defects. Okay, and that's one that there may indeed be a way to kind of think about that in these Moiré systems. Does that answer your question?
I suppose.
Okay, so good. So okay, good. So let me just say, but I'm going to come back to that in a couple of slides. Okay, so this is E and this is M. Okay, and basically you can check using their string operators that they're both bosons. So you take this red string is a product of poly X's. Poly X commutes with itself. So you take the string, wiggle it around, do anything to it. If there's only red strings in the problem, there's no phases. And similarly, if there's only blue strings, which are products of poly Z, there's no phases. And you can see that, look, here's a sort of picture in which I created a pair of E's. I then created a pair of M's and walked one M around the endpoint of the string and brought it back. And I have a single point here where I have acted first with a poly X and then with a poly Z, right? And then if I now re-annihilate, these guys, these two loops, I get a phase factor of -1, okay? So this is where the statistics come from. Okay, and like I said, this is E and this is M, and topologically they're the same. Now, one thing that's worth pointing out is that, in this model, okay, there's no symmetry relating E and M because, E lives on the vertices of the lattice, and M lives on the vertices of the dual lattice. Okay, And I will tell you in a few slides about one way that you can get a model that has that symmetry, but you need something a little bit more involved. Okay. But you might ask, well, okay, does this model have symmetry defects? Okay. Yes, it does. And here's a picture, again, you know, from one of these early papers. This one was by Kataev and Kong. And they basically said, look, make some kind of lattice defect, okay, which kind of looks like a defect by a half translation. And what they showed is that you can, you know, if you sort of make an E on this side of the defect and push it through, it has to come out as an M unless it leaves some kind of local excitation on this wall, okay? And now, you know, you observe that, look, I made a pair of E's here, okay, which I could do from the vacuum. I pulled one across to here, okay? Now I have an E on one side and an M on the other side. If I bring them back together at the top, they make a fermion, but I can't pull a single fermion from the vacuum. So where did the other fermion come from? Well, there must be, you know, some multidimensional Hilbert space associated with the endpoints of this defect. And that these two ends collectively can either have a fermion or not have a fermion. Okay, that's sort of the only thing that's consistent. And that is why these guys, and that's the sense in which these defects are sort of non-abelian, that they have multiple internal states. And a very pleasing thing about this picture is that recently, a year or so ago, the Google group did an experiment in which they essentially created these defects in the Toric code and showed, you know, indeed that you can send an E through and have it come out as an M and so on. So there's now been a kind of experiment working with this setup. Good. Oh, I better speed up. All right, perfect. So, and you know, the other thing that I'll say about this symmetry is that, you know, another thing that's easy to show is that the Toric code, if you look at the boundary, so I've been lazy and I haven't drawn the lattice down here, okay, but the boundary of the Toric code has two gapped boundaries, which we can think of as happening by sort of just condensing either E's or M's outside of this region. So if you like field theory, you can make a boundary to the Higgs phase by condensing E, or a boundary to the confined phase by condensing M. And you know, we know that these two are adiabatically connected. So there's nothing weird about the vacuum up here, okay? You know, if you sort of look again at this edge, at the interface, you know, there's again, you know, something like this non-abelian defect. And these two gapped boundaries, because one is condensing E and one is condensing M, are related by this anion permuting symmetry. Okay. The other observation that has been made about these, you know, two boundaries is that, you know, you can, of course, think about the edge of the Toric code as, you know, you could sort of draw some spins in here and say, oh, this looks a lot like an Ising model. And there's a couple of different ways that you might want to do this. If you want to do it with Ising symmetry, okay, from the form of the Hamiltonians in these two regions, it's sort of natural to say, you know, that the spins sort of live in different places in these two representations, because then your boundary Hamiltonian, you know, actually has Ising symmetry. And you know, it's also a well-known fact that and then these would represent two different phases of the Ising model, and it's a well-known fact that those are related by something that we call Kramers-Vanier duality. Okay. More specifically, on this side, the plaquette term and the Hamiltonian you can think of as sigma x, and this looks like the paramagnetic phase, okay? And on this side, the plaquette term you can think of as a poly-Z, and this one looks like the ferromagnetic phase of the Ising model, which is you know, dual by what we call Kramers-Vanier duality to this paramagnetic phase. Okay. You know, and again, yeah. So like I said, you know, if you make these defects between them, you can again convince yourself that you know, it's the same argument. You make a pair of, you know, that basically you can pull an E in here, you can pull an M in here, and then, you know, you have an extra fermion in your bulk. So there must be some capacity of this boundary state to eat up fermions. Okay, and this was used. This idea, you know, has been used to propose a number of experimental platforms for, you know, again, making these kinds of non-abelian defects, which led to a considerable amount of effort and investment by Microsoft in sort of one-dimensional superconducting wires. Okay, so great. So this is the anion-permuting symmetry, this EM swap symmetry of the Torah code. Okay, there's a symmetry at the level of topological order, though not at the level of Kataev's Hamiltonian. This symmetry relates these two kinds of gapped boundaries. And you know, if you try and sort of go and write down an assignment of, you know, sort of a little Ising model that you want to associate with your edge, it's natural to think of these two boundaries as related by Kramers-Vanier duality. So suggest that, you know, there's a kind of link between this duality and the bulk anion-permuting symmetry. And you might ask, okay, well, like, who really cares about Kramers-Vanier duality? It's kind of something we've known about for a long time. And the reason that, you know, people care is that recently, you know, this sort of started in the condensed matter literature, I would say, but has really caught on in the high energy literature, that, you know, people have been thinking about this idea that maybe symmetry as we know it should be generalized, okay, and that there are things, you know, that basically what is a symmetry, okay, it need not necessarily be a group-like thing, but you should really think of a symmetry in a one-dimensional system as, you know, what you can obtain, actions that you can obtain by acting with topological line operators, okay? And, you know, an example, which has been discussed in detail by a number of references, and the picture here is from a paper by Lin and Shao, you know, for the Ising, if on this, you know, if I have a sort of Ising theory in one dimensions, and I have these line operators, okay, so here's my state in one spatial dimension, and I can have different topological line operators, a Z2 one and one called sigma, which has non-group-like fusion rules. This is the sense in which we call it non-invertible. But you know, this topological line operator sigma can act on the boundary. Okay. And so indeed, So who cares about, you know, things like Kramers-Vanier duality? The point is that you know, if you have these topological lines and they leave the boundary state invariant, you know, what do we do with symmetries? We use them to obtain interesting constraints on, for example, quantum field theories. And you know, maybe these kind of more general topological line operators can be used to do that too. And you know, maybe this would be useful for, you know, ultimately for finding new structure in sort of quantum field theories. So that's the idea. Okay. Good. Okay. Yes.
Why are you saying that symmetry is not a symmetry for the lattice model?
It's simply not because if you exchange E and M, you have to take the lattice to the dual lattice.
Yeah, but that's also, if I see your Ising model and you do the Kramers-Vanier, you're kind of exchanging lattice to dual lattice. So I don't find that like convincing.
So right, but so Kramers-Vanier duality is not a symmetry. It's like in the. Well, it's a non-invertible symmetry, right? So it's not a unitary operator that I can kind of carry out at the lattice level.
But it's a non-invertible symmetry.
That's right. So but what I'm saying in terms of the Torah code is something more pedestrian, which is simply that, you know, if I take the Torah code Hamiltonian, you know, there's not like a unitary operation that I can write down in Kataev's Torah code that swaps E and M. Right, and you can say, well, you know, the symmetry is kind of there, and I just changed the lattice to lattice, and I don't dispute that. I'm just sort of saying at a very concrete level, you know, in the traditional sense, if I have an operator that commutes with a Hamiltonian, that's not there. That's a pedestrian.
How do I reconcile that with this? If I add like transverse field terms and I go along the self-dual line, eventually I'll get to this first order line that people say spontaneously breaks that EM exchange symmetry, but that's definitely there at the lattice level. So like, what's going on along the first order line where you have two ground states?
So are you talking about the first order line in the like in the Torah code when you look at this phase diagram?
Yeah, like I add like linear and x, like sum over x and then sum over z.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I have the coefficients be the same, and I go along that self-dual line. Eventually I leave the z2 topologically ordered phase, and I go along this like first order line that has two ground states. Mm-hmm. People usually say like, oh, that first order line spontaneously breaks the EM exchange. But if there's no EM exchange at the lattice level, why is there two ground states then?
So you could, if you, you know, I think there's various ways that you could formulate it, right? So I think that if you wanted to think about that, the thing that you would say is that, you know, there is a symmetry which, you know, swaps E and M, and then you have this kind of, if you like, half lattice translation that takes the lattice to the dual lattice. And the point is that, you know, if you're in the continuum, right, that, you know, the fact that you have a symmetry, or, you know, look, there's a version of the toric code called the Wendt-Plaquette model, which realizes this, you know, in a slightly cleaner way, right, that E and M are exchanged by essentially a lattice translation. And so if you ask about, you know, I have some critical point, I want to know properties, you know, of the infrared quantum field theory associated with that critical point, you know, the fact that the symmetry involves some kind of lattice translation, you know, so there are ways, and this is something that, you know, that like Natty Seiberg and Xuheng Shao have some recent papers making this very concrete, right? There's ways to sort of say, oh, you know, this lattice action is this, and maybe it involves this half translation, but, you know, in the continuum, that can really kind of impose some constraints in the continuum field theory. And so I think that's the right way to think about that situation. Yeah.
Saying that there's not a symmetry because it doesn't preserve the Hamiltonian, but maybe you can just weaken the notion of a symmetry and say it preserves the state, ground state itself, and permutes different selection sectors.
Sure. Yeah. But let me keep going though, because we can write down another Hamiltonian in which it is very, very much a symmetry in the most ordinary boring sense of the word, and I think that's kind of a useful thing to do here. Yeah. Good. Okay. All right, so what I want to kind of get at in the rest of this talk is that, you know, this story sort of suggests that there's a connection between these anion permuting symmetries and, you know, something to do with duality at the boundary. You know, this idea has been mentioned in a few other papers, but I want to kind of go through our version of the story, its consequences for, you know, something that you might call a kind of anomaly inflow type of picture. As well as, you know, a kind of framework that allows you to maybe explore or construct dualities and theories with discrete symmetries that maybe were not obvious from the start. Okay. So in order to do this, what I would like to do is, you know, show you a construction in which I'm going to call the shaded Ising string net, okay, which realizes the toric code topological order with an explicit on-site Z2 symmetry. Okay. So that's going to be the first part of this. And in order to do this, I'm going to use a construction called a string net construction. I don't have time to go over the details, but basically, if you are familiar with fusion categories, the idea is that I'm going to define, you know, I'm going to think of some, you know, Hilbert space of graphs, okay, with trivalent vertices. Each edge of the graph carries a label, okay? These labels are associated with objects in a fusion category, and I can think of these graphs in much the same way as I can think of the ground state of the toric code as a kind of soup of loops, okay? I can think of these graphs, these labeled graphs, and making a sort of certain kind of soup of them called a string net as representing the ground state wave function of some system. And okay, you know, what does the soup mean? Well, in the toric code, it's a soup of loops. And more generally, there's some data associated with the relative configurations of different, you know, kind of different loop configurations in this soup. And that data is associated with a unitary modular fusion category. Okay. And, you know, in order for your ground state wave function to be well defined, and in other words, in order for each configuration to have a unique coefficient, there's some consistency relations that come out of this, which, you know, again, people who are familiar with fusion category will recognize things like the pentagon equation. Okay. So I can do this, you know, like I said, if you let me have any, you know, any Hilbert space that I want, I'm not constrained by what real materials can do. One can write down these string net models, and you can realize a very wide variety of topological orders, indeed any kind of Drin-filled center, so any topological order that admits a gapped boundary to the vacuum. okay, so the class of these is quite large. Now, one of the observations that I can make is that, in general, if I'm aiming at a specific topological order, There's not a unique kind of string net formulation that I can write down that realizes it. So often, you know, there's sort of more than one way that I could have this string net that will give me the same topological order. Okay? And this allows us, if we want to do something that we call shading this topological order. This picture is something that I'm working on with Kevin Walker. So that's the we. And you know, basically the idea, so you know, I have two different string nets with the same topological order. And this red line represents something called a Morita equivalence between the two. Okay? And basically, given a Morita equivalence between, you know, two different realizations of the same topological order, I can introduce a shading with two colors, okay? Where, you know, in this region, I just have string net A, okay, as usual. In the white region, I just have string net B. And then this red line represents this thing that we call the Morita equivalence between them. Okay. And basically, Morita equivalences, by definition, you know, have the right kind of data that I can, you know, that I can kind of write down a string net type ground state wave function. Okay. So let me, to make this concrete, talk about the shaded Ising string net. Okay. So, you know, at some level, you're like, well, the Torah code is the Torah code. But mathematically speaking, there are actually kind of two different ways that I could think about getting the Torah code. Okay. And, you know, I could think of the edge degrees of freedom as sort of representing like magnetic fields, okay, so group elements of the group Z2. Or I could think of them as representing electric fields, okay, so representations of the group Z2. And the reason that these two look the same for abelian groups is, of course, that, you know, these two are isomorphic, again, you know, for abelian groups, not for non-abelian groups, okay? And in each case, I have two edge labels that, you know, just fuse to the identity. Okay. And so now, you know, there is a sort of non-trivial Morita equivalence between them, which is actually this sort of topologically, it's related to the topologically non-trivial line operator of the Ising conformal field theory. Okay, and so that's the label I'm going to put on these edges in between. And so now I have this shading, okay? And you can show that, you can convince yourself rather easily that the topological order in this shading of this shaded string net is the same as that of the original string net, okay? I'm going to show you two kinds of excitations, E and M, okay? And there's an obvious symmetry here. I have black regions and white regions. And because, you know, the labels in the A region are isomorphic to the labels in the B region, right? There is a symmetry that just swaps these two, okay? And that's going to be our symmetry that exchanges E and M, okay? So, you know, how do I make point particles? Well, you know, there's sort of two kinds of operators. So in each region, I have an E-like operator and an M-like operator, and what you find is that when these guys cross the red lines, they change in character, right? And so this gives us sort of two kinds of excitations. So I have a kind of white Z or M-like string and a gray X or E-like string, okay? And I'm going to call this guy a kind of gray E particle, okay? And of course, there's another particle, right, which has, in the white region, it has this E-like string. And in the gray region, it has this M-like string. And so we could call this the gray M particle. Okay. And so, you know, like I said, but obviously, right, like I said, you know, when I apply this symmetry and just swap the shadings, okay, after this global symmetry, my white E becomes a gray E, which is actually the white M. Okay. And so this symmetry interchanges the two anions. Okay. And so now if it's useful to bear in mind that, you know, these string net states are kind of these different region colors are fluctuating. Okay, and so if I really want to sort of compare the two things, what I can do is do this color swap operation plus a bunch of sort of, you know, I can think of them as local moves, okay, on my string net, which just bring me to a different sort of piece of my string net ground state in which the colors have been restored to their original configuration, okay? And it's particularly interesting to ask what, yes?
So how is this related to the string net for the SET?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so I should say that this construction, the shaded, so I think this notion of shading is a little bit more general than you know what was written in, you know, what we described in this paper here, and you know, this paper here has a similar idea. But this construction here is exactly the string net for the SET. Yeah. Is that your question?
But the Hamiltonians and everything are somewhat different from the SET, or they're exactly the same?
In this case, you can, I mean, the ground state is the same. So, you know, you can phrase the Hamiltonian in multiple different ways, but
another question is,
yeah.
Suppose that you took the vec G, where G is a non-abelian group, and vec G, then could you also construct like a SET for that?
Right. So in that case, what happens is you can still do this shading, right? There's still a Morita equivalence, and I can color the string net in two different colors. But in that case, these regions A and B are not isomorphic, so I don't have, you know, that the, in general, for non-abelian groups, there's not, they're not isomorphic, and so then I don't have this symmetry, actually. Like, I can shade it, but there isn't that symmetry, actually. Yeah, yes?
Can I think of these shaded string nets as realizing the relative Drinfeld-centered topological order, or symmetry-enriched topological order? Analogy with how, like, normal string nets realize the
Drinfeld center
order.
So the, okay, so now I'm not, the word relative Drinfeld center, I think you might have to explain to me, but the statement here is that the shading does not change the topological order.
Yes.
So the topological order is the toric code. What the shading can do, okay, if the regions A and B are like isomorphic, like the local Hilbert space is the same and the data describing the ground state is the same, you know, or is isomorphic, okay, is that these models allow you to have this symmetry and you can have it in an on-site way. Yeah. Okay.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So, in the cases where A and B are isomorphic in this line and would have what you call symmetry, is that symmetry always invertible?
Yeah, this is an ordinary, so this symmetry action is as boring as it gets, right? You call the gray like some spin up and the white some spin down, and I just flip all my spins. It's as boring as it gets. Yeah. Okay. But yeah, but I do want to say that, you know, actually, like, you know, and maybe I'll draw a little picture on the board. You know, but basically, so I have, you know, my white region and my gray region. But of course, you know, in any given ground state, you know, I would have this plus, you know, a bunch of, you know, regions where the colors are different, okay? And, you know, somewhere over here, there's going to be some ground state, you know, where the white and gray are flipped, okay? So now I do this color switch, right? And I have, you know, kind of white on the outside and so on, okay? But now what I can do is I can take, you know, in this ground state, I can sort of look, right? So the ground state is a big soup with all kinds of different string configurations and all kinds of different color configurations. And I can go over here and I can look at the color configure, you know, at part of this ground state after this symmetry action that has the same shading. And that can be useful, and it's particularly enlightening to do that on the boundary, okay? So on the boundary, so this, yes?
Maybe I'll hold up on the vec G versus vec G.
Yes, yes.
Those two symmetries are more equivalent.
They're Morita equivalent, but more than that, the fusion category vec z2 is isomorphic to the fusion category rep z2.
Yeah, but this green, this chain construction seems to work whenever you have more equivalent.
That's right. But you only have the symmetry when you have an isomorphism. Because otherwise, if I go and I swap the gray and the white regions, you can tell that I did that, right? It doesn't look the same.
If you consider that interface to be a defect in the triple center box, is vec g or rep g, isn't that like a domain wall that is non-vertical?
Yes. Yes. So good. Yeah. So So what is this red line? Okay. So for people familiar with string nets, okay, this red line, you know, this is exactly the loops associated with this, you know, with this label sigma in the Ising fusion category. And so if, now, you know, in this shading, okay, the red lines can only live at the domain walls between the black region and the white region. And that is why I don't get any extra anions associated with these guys, okay? But if I allowed these to be open, what I would, you know, if I gauge the symmetry, right, I would essentially get back to an Ising string net. And then indeed, I do have these defects, which are these Majorana's. Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Okay. Okay. Yes?
So if there is an isomorphism of categories, are we always guaranteed that there is a symmetry in the Grenfell center which permutes those two categories?
Yes, I would say if there's an isomorphism in these fusion categories, then I can always, you know, if I have an isomorphism between two Morita equivalent fusion categories, okay, then I can always build this string net with this shading and have some kind of symmetry, okay, and you know, often that symmetry is some, you know, interesting, let's say, okay, in the sense that it permutes anions, okay. So good. So it's, you know, particularly interesting to kind of look in a little bit more detail at what this does to the boundary. So again, I've sort of cut off the bulk. Think of the bulk as coming down here. And let's look at the gapped boundaries of this system. So basically, you know, in each toric code region, I could have a smooth boundary, which I'm drawing here with a black line across the top. Okay, so this is just, you know, I complete all of my plaquette operators here are full plaquettes. Okay. And a rough boundary, okay, which, and in this case, that actually, I'm going to draw that with a red line across the top, and that's because, you know, my psi string, if I fuse it into this red line, the red line doesn't change, okay, so this is, you know, basically, like, there's only a single label that can live on this top edge, okay, and, you know, like the toric code, okay, my shaded Ising string net has two different kinds of gapped boundaries, right? The rough white and smooth gray boundary, in which I can think of as having condensed the particle that is the white E and the gray M along the boundary. Okay. And the other kind of boundary is the smooth white and rough gray boundary, right, where I condense the particle that's the white M and the gray E. Okay. And these two boundaries are related to each other by symmetry. Okay. You know, and like one way to think about that is that this symmetry interchanges the E and the M, right? And specifically, it interchanges the white E and the white M, right? And very concretely, I could start with this picture of the boundary here, okay? Sorry, there should be a red edge going down in the bulk. I can see that I missed that. But I could start with this picture of the boundary here. Step one, I just swap the shadings, okay? Step two, I do a bunch of local moves and essentially pull this red loop into the bulk and push another red loop up here, okay? And now I can see that what I have done is I've gone from a boundary which is rough white, smooth gray, to a boundary that is smooth white and rough gray. Okay. So these two boundaries are related to each other by the action of the Z2 symmetry. Okay. And you know, it's kind of, and so and now let me, you know, just make a comment about the connection between this this and Kramers-Vanier duality on the boundary. So, you know, let's sort of look at the local moves that are involved in this last step of the process, okay? And basically, you know, you can, I'm just going to kind of flash these for those of you who are familiar with the Ising fusion category, but basically, you can convince yourself by looking at the, you know, the kind of coefficients in here that what these local moves do, if I sort of push this region up to the boundary, and sorry, I should be drawing a red edge on the top here, okay? But if I push this region up to the boundary, what they do is they sort of exchange, you know, information that was contained in these edges coming in here, okay, with sort of information, you know, so information maybe about vertex defects here, with information about plaquette defects, okay.
Yes? Minus sign?
Okay, so this minus sign comes from, yeah, so here I have a psi string coming in, okay, and so basically what I'm doing to pull this up here involves an F move, okay. And so, you know, basically in that F move, there's a minus sign. And so that's where it comes from. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Whereas on this side, there was no blue loop coming in. The blue loop is the psi, and so they get a plus sign. So this information about the parity of these edges, you know, which is somehow information about charges, is now transferred to information about these relative phases, which is sort of now information you associate with fluxes. Okay. And so, you know, what that actually means in terms of our spin model is that when I pull this loop to the boundary and I want to kind of naturally associate spins with the edge in a way that is compatible with my spin Hamiltonian having Ising symmetry, this, you know, process actually corresponds to, you know, Cramer's Vanier duality. Okay. Good. And good. So the kind of morals of this is that, you know, we have a model. It has this on-site shading swap symmetry, which permutes E and M particles. On the boundary, this, you know, I have two kinds of gap boundary, which are related by shading swap. Okay. And that, you know, if we sort of do this process where we swap and then come back to the same sort of original shading configuration, what we see in our spin model is Cramer's Vanier duality. Okay. And, you know, that these sort of duality, you know, defects, these lines that are carrying out the duality in our spin model in this sense, have, you know, are associated with the same kind of topological data as these Morita equivalences on the boundary regions. Okay. Okay, and so, you know, so fine, this is some lattice model that, you know, I think in some sense, you know, realizes many things that have already been understood in the literature in some sense or other. But you might ask, you know, what do we learn about this? And without, you know, going into detail, I think one observation that is very obvious when you frame this in this way is you can ask, look, you know, if I have Cramer's Vanier duality in this 1D system, can I have a kind of trivial, you know, product state gapped boundary? Okay. And now we can ask that question in this model, you know, that you know, kind of that respects all of the symmetries, including this non-invertible symmetry. Okay. And in this model, that question translates to the question of, I have this bulk model, okay, with this symmetry that exchanges E and M. Can I write down some like nice trivial gapped boundary that's invariant under that symmetry, right? As in, you know, so the gap boundary that I showed you necessarily has sort of two pieces that are related by the action of the symmetry. Okay, so that's not what I'm calling trivial. What I'm calling trivial is I really hit it with the symmetry and I get back the same thing, okay, and it's gapped. And the answer is no, right? And the reason is that, there's no boson, okay? If I take E and M together, that's a fermion. There's no boson that I can condense that's invariant under this symmetry, okay? So this makes a kind of, you know, relationship between this, you know, kind of simple statement that I have this, you know, bulk phase that has this EM swap symmetry, and that system cannot have a boundary that's, you know, that's gapped and symmetric. That, you know, relates that rather obvious statement to a statement about the fact that, you know, when I have a model, a 1D model that's invariant under Cramer's Vanier duality, I can't have a unique gapped, you know, kind of ground state. Okay, good. And so in the last, you know, maybe couple of minutes, okay, so all of this was very specific to this model. And in the last couple of minutes, I want to kind of sketch some of the tools that we are, you know, working on, and hopefully the paper will be out soon, about the more general picture of this construction, okay? So, you know, basically, like I said, anytime there are two ways to realize the same string net, so I have two Morita equivalent fusion categories, I can use them to have a shading, right? If these two ways look the same, so if there's an isomorphism between these two fusion categories, we have a symmetry, okay? And at the gapped boundary in general, this symmetry corresponds to some kind of duality between different 1D phases of the same spin model, right? So this is where the fact that these, you know, these two categories are isomorphic means that, you know, whatever the Hilbert space is on this boundary, right, and whatever the symmetries are in this boundary, they can be the same in both of the shadings. Okay. And, you know, in general, when I do this, I'm going to have, you know, two different boundary conditions, like smooth gray and smooth white. And so these gap boundaries always kind of break the symmetry. Okay. Good.
So yes. You think the boundaries always have edge modes, like two-fold degenerate modes?
So I should say that there's sort of not all Morita equivalences are created equal. Okay, so things like this charge conjugation symmetry, for example, okay, I can just, so let me talk very concretely about like the Z3 string net, okay? So I have three labels, you know, 0, 1, and 2 with 1 times 2 is 0, okay? And so, you know, there is a Morita equivalence, okay, which interchanges 1 and 2. But that one's a little, you know, one observation about that is that, you know, that's already kind of symmetry. Like, I actually don't need to shade. That symmetry is already there at the level of the string net, okay? You know, basically, those anions being exchanged by that symmetry, they have trivial mutual statistics. So, okay, Cramer's Wanger duality, or in general, you know, which you can generalize to other abelian groups, involves exchanging charges and fluxes, and those happen. So it's kind of a more non-trivial kind of Morita equivalence. It's not there as a symmetry of the lattice model, kind of at step, you know, from the beginning. And it exchanges anions that actually have non-trivial mutual statistics. And it's that sort of non-triviality, right? Because E and M have non-trivial mutual statistics, their product is not a boson, and I can't condense it. And so that would be my answer to this question is, you know, when I have a shading that results in an anion permutation where, you know, the product of the two is not a boson, then I expect that I cannot have a unique gapped boundary that is invariant under this symmetry.
And there's like no terms I can add only to the boundary to like polarize everything to some trivial product state on the boson.
Not without breaking the symmetry.
Okay.
Yeah, not without breaking the symmetry. So you can, you know, it's a kind of like an SPT. I can always break the symmetry, but yeah, you have to break it. Yeah, good. Okay. Yeah, and so, you know, you might ask more generally, suppose that I write down my favorite spin model, which has some global symmetry group G, right? And you might be curious to know, like, okay, the Ising model, fine, Cramer's Wanger duality. Well, we've known about that for a long time. And you might want to ask, you know, what are all the non-invertible symmetries that are sort of, you know, maybe associated with this symmetry G, right? A related question, and I'm not going to say these are, you know, absolutely one-to-one, although in the models that we have worked out, they are, right? But a related question is, given a topological order, what are all of the potential anion permuting symmetries in that topological order? And, you know, what are the associated sort of symmetry defects or lines, you know, that sort of separate these different anion regions? You know, what are they? What's their topological data? And we do have an answer to that question, which comes from building a shaded string net associated with what Kevin calls the completed fusion category. The idea here is the following. So, you know, I have some fusion category C. In our previous example, it was Z2, okay, that's associated with a topological order, and I'm going to have that same topological order in each, you know, in each region and in the whole string net, okay? So how do I complete this category? I can pick a set of region labels, each of which are associated with a different algebra object of C. And from the point of view of my string net, that actually means they're each associated with a different kind of gapped boundary of this string net, okay? And so, you know, again, in our example, you know, there's sort of two regions. One is the trivial, the trivial algebra object, and the other is the algebra object vec Z2, right? This is our sort of smooth boundary. This was our rough boundary, okay? And those would have been our two regions, okay? For the more general case, you know, if I have some group, okay, these choice of algebra objects or gapped boundaries of the VEC-G string net, this has been known in the math literature for some time, are specified by subgroups of G and their cocycles, okay? Which, you know, incidentally is all 1D phases with, you know, that you could have associated with symmetry group G, right? All of the spontaneous symmetry broken phases, all of the SPT phases in 1D are all in here. Okay. Yes? Yes. So algebra object actually refers, you know, at a technical level to something you do to the fusion category. But yes, you can think of it as associated to a Lagrangian algebra in the topological order. Yes. Yes. This statement about, like, this is really a subgroup and a cocycle, and that's why, you know, it's kind of like associated with the fusion category. Yeah. Good. Okay, and then, you know, Okay, so now I have these algebra objects, okay, and then, you know, the edges in each region are, you know, associated with bimodule objects between the different algebra objects, okay. And, you know, basically, I don't want to go into details, but this gives you a sort of constructive approach for finding, you know, if you give me a G, I can sort of construct all of the different, different colors that I could go into my shaded G string net, okay, and I can tell you what the edge labels in each region should be, and also what the edge labels kind of on the boundaries between these different regions should be. So it's a sort of constructive approach. And I better finish soon. Okay, so this gives me a shaded string net with the same topological order as I would have gotten from the C string net, okay? There's a one-to-one correspondence between these bulk regions and the possible gapped boundaries, okay? And I have these red edges, which are associated with, you know, any, so I have a red edge for every non-trivial, in the sense that we just talked about, Morita equivalence, okay? And I can systematically obtain the resulting topological order. And, you know, I'm kind of out of time, but, you know, let me just sort of flash up a couple of, you know, maybe more interesting examples. One is for Z2 cross Z2. There was another paper that discusses this example from, and I forget the year, it was by Ryan Thorngren. Okay, so a bunch of people have looked at, you know, Z2 cross Z2 and made, you know, sort of statements about the possible phases and so on. But, okay, so here, you know, there's actually six different regions, okay, six different kinds of gap boundaries. And let me just go to the next slide. So the six different kinds of gap boundaries correspond to fully breaking the Z2 symmetry, breaking a Z2 subgroup of the Z2 cross Z2 symmetry, and you can do that in three different ways, okay? Or fully preserving the Z2 cross Z2 symmetry. And again, you can do that in two different ways. This is the ordinary Z2 cross Z2 paramagnet, and this is the SPT, okay? And then, you know, you can just sort of go through and construct all of the edge labels in these regions and all of the dualities between them, okay? And you can also do this for non-abelian groups. Let me just sort of say that, for example, if you do this in S3, you find an interesting, for abelian groups, like all of these regions are always, actually, I should say this, all of these regions are always isomorphic, okay? So you have a ton of symmetries in this model. It's not so obvious for non-abelian groups, but, you know, some of them do have it. So a nice example is if you take S3 and you complete it, okay, you find that there's like two different kinds of regions that have six different edge labels and two different kinds of regions that have three different edge labels, okay? And so there is actually a non-trivial anion permuting symmetry in here, which actually was previously known in the literature, but it pops very nicely out of this construction, okay? And so, yeah, I just wanted to kind of flash that, you know, this there is this tool called the completion of the category, which allows us to kind of concretely construct new dualities, these duality, you know, a string net with, the, you know, these kind of dualities manifest. And, you know, if there are new kind of symmetries in their permuting anions, we can realize them at the lattice level in an on-site manner and kind of extract the topological data associated with these defect lines that separate the different regions. Okay, and since I am out of time and I don't want to hold up lunch, I'll just leave the summary and take any further questions.
Let's take maybe one or two more questions if there are any, since it's late.
For example, the Dahmer standard EM exchange defect has contained S on the line.
So it's containing?
You can view the EM exchange defect as condensing the particle S on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, it's a condenser.
Yeah.
Is it possible to formulate like, any sort of like duality as condensing certain fermionic objects on the line?
That's, you know, I haven't thought about that, so I don't know, but I'd certainly be interested in discussing. Yeah.
Is this completion story related to gauging these anion exchange symmetries? Is it like a more concrete version?
So, okay, I guess what I would say is that the shaded completed string net, okay, if you gauged it, you would get some ordinary string net, you know, which would be associated with sort of taking all, you know, all of these, you know, or, well, actually not all, okay? So the Z2 cross Z2 actually has like 72 anion permeating symmetries, but some of them are associated with these, you know, like there's this symmetry that I just exchanged the two Z2s, okay? And so there's some subgroup of the symmetry that's just that, okay? We're not gauging that, but, you know, anything to do with kind of these more non-trivial duality ones, you're gauging that symmetry, and then you're getting this bigger, you know, so all of those symmetries you'd gauge, you get this bigger topological order, essentially.
The Z2 symmetry of the S3 gauge theory that you were discussing, is it is there a boundary a gap boundary that has that symmetry, or is there...
Oh my gosh. I don't think so. So actually, and the reason that I don't think so is that, you know, the fact that this is, you know, like this is a non-trivial Morita equivalent. So that kind of means that, you know, if you thought of this as condensing something, right? So this guy would be condensing charges, okay? And this guy is condensing something else, okay? And this is somehow, you know, it's condensing, I actually am not sure exactly what, but it's not just condensing charges, right? It's some kind of, you know, it's condensing some kind of dions or something like that. And so therefore I think that these guys will probably have non-trivial mutual statistics, and therefore
it would be interesting to look at the transition between these two under conditions.
Yes. Yes.
See if you can get the S3 invariant S3 SFT with S3 symmetry, I assume, because it has to be coupled to S3 gauge theory.
Yes. Yes, okay. Yeah, very good.
All right, let's thank you.